trails aren't just for hikers. For that matter, they're not just for people. Lots of animals use trails, it turns out, and we get into thinking about our various pathways in a deeper way with the help of Robert Moore. He's the author of a book that does mention specific trails, but not in anything like a guidebook. His book is called On Trails, An Exploration. Robert Moore has written shorter pieces for Harper's, GQ, New York, and other outfits, and has won several awards for his efforts. This is his first book. Robert is also the recipient of a Middlebury Fellowship in Environmental Journalism. Robert Moore, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
So here's a great way to start any book. I spent 5 months staring at mud. What was going on there?
Yeah, so in 2009, I left to go hike the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine, and it just turned out to be one of those years, which is a really rainy year. And so what happens when it rains like that is that the clouds come in, and you get kind of socked in on a lot of the summits, and a lot of your hiking is spent just staring at your feet, which I think initially can seem like a disappointment to a lot of hikers. You know, our experience of hiking is so visual in so many ways. It's about seeing vistas. It's about looking out from mountaintops. And so when you don't have that, you kind of turn inward. And one of the things I started thinking about a lot is the trail that was running right beneath my feet.
Well, so if the weather had been better, might your thinking of about trails have evolved a bit differently?
It's possible, yeah.
All right. So you see, you're not just musing about people and trails. What else are you musing about in the book?
Well, so once you start thinking about trails as these structures that lead us through life, you know, you're walking on a trail and you don't really think about it. It's just something that's there. Preferably, you don't think about it at all. You're thinking about the woods. You're thinking about the mountains. You're thinking about other things. It just sort of leads you invisibly. But when you start looking at it very closely, you start to realize that trails are this fundamental structure on the planet that lead all sorts of animals, allow us to communicate, allow us to make sense out of the chaos of landscape and find our way from here to there. And so as I was hiking, I started to notice other trails. I would notice game trails going through the woods, for example, deer paths. I started to notice ant pheromone trails, you know, which everyone has seen as kids, but you don't really stop to think about. And then I started to think about the metaphor of the path, which you find not just in our culture, but across cultures and in most religions. It's a really fundamental metaphor for finding your way through life, and I think there's a good reason for that.
You mentioned the ant pheromone trails. I think a lot of us can relate to seeing lots and lots and lots of ants in one place, and they're traveling in what looks like a freeway system, and we can't figure out why they travel in that direction. What are they doing then to make them all follow the same order?
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable system that they have worked out, and it's maybe the most complex form of trail making that we know about, which is they lay down pheromones, which are chemical signals, which indicate to other ants where food might be. And the brilliance of these different signaling systems, ants have all sorts of different types of trails. They can modulate the intensity of the trail. They can some of them don't use trails at all because they will evaporate too quickly, for example, in desert environments. But many of them do. And what they're doing is creating a way to indicate to the other ants where all the food is and where the nest is without having to do any other forms of direct communication. And what that allows is to have very individual ants can be very stupid, can have very low individual intelligence, and yet it allows for this amazingly complex collective intelligence so that they will always find their way to the food in the most efficient manner over time. And they will, just incredible networks. They never have traffic jams. We study, because of the efficiency of their networks, we will study their networks to better improve our routing systems for information through the internet. They call it ant algorithms.
Wow.
Or we will study them to figure out how to ship packages across the country, or how to schedule tasks in a soap factory. I mean, they actually do these collective tasks more efficiently than we do as people.
There's a great anecdote in here, though, about E.O. Wilson, who discovered the dewfors gland in a fire ant. And what did he do with this information once he'd figured out what the pheromone organ was?
Yeah, it's a great little anecdote. What he did was, so he dug through a fire ant. No one at that time, we had known since about the time of a Genevan entomologist named Charles Bonnet in the 18th century, we had known that ants are probably communicating using chemicals, but no one had ever pinpointed how exactly they were doing it. And so what Wilson did was he cracked open a fire ant, he went digging through the organs, and he pulled them out one by one, and he would use this little birch, this stick of birch wood, and he would smear them across a glass pane near a fire ant hill. And one by one, he would draw these lines with the organs, and nothing, nothing, nothing. Finally, he smeared out the Dufour's gland, and he said that they rushed to that line, you know, in a mad rush, because it was as if, you know, you can imagine if you woke up in your house one day and the house was full of the smell of, you know, sizzling bacon and eggs and coffee. You know, you would go sniffing around, you're trying to figure out where the smell was coming from. That's essentially what these ants were doing. They were being tricked into following this line, which they thought would lead them to an enormous cache of food. But, of course, it didn't lead anywhere. So what Wilson found he could do with this is he could actually write his name on the ground using this pheromone. He went and actually isolated the pheromone by gathering millions of ants and basically reducing the Dufour's glands into this isolated pheromone, which he had synthesized. And then he could write his name on the ground, and the ants would actually line up to spell his name right there on the floor.
Spell your name in fire ants. Step right up. Wow, that's an amazing story. But it's something about how we move in trails, and it's not just us. It's ants and cows and sea anemones even we get into in this book. It's called On Trails, An Exploration. Robert Moore, the author, is with us on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation too. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Robert and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Robert Moore. He is he's won awards for his environmental journalism, and now has written his first book. It's called On Trails, An Exploration. It's not just a guidebook. In fact, there are no maps in this at all. There are some illustrations that go with the work, but it's about an exploration of trails themselves, why we create them, and the fact that we are not the only creature that does so. Lots of other creatures use and create trails. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the subject matter. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I love the idea, Robert, that cows laid out Boston, but you cite a University of Oregon study that took a rather similar tack in studying cows and trails. What did it find out?
What it found, the study set out to find basically whether a computer could beat a cow in finding the most efficient route from one side of a field to another. Most efficient meaning using the least amount of energy to cross the field. And what they ultimately found was that cows are actually better than our most advanced computers currently at finding the most efficient route from one side to the other. They are just through iteration, just through walking the field multiple times and always trying to conserve their energy, they actually do a better job than we can once again.
Wow. So there's a lot to be said for people who don't necessarily use the guidebooks but go by the lay of the land. Now, I'm not by any means suggesting that people take off into the woods without trails, and I don't think you are either.
Well, no, I wouldn't necessarily say that you should never go off trail. I think there's actually quite a bit of value to that, and I've done quite a bit of off trail hiking in Wyoming and Montana and elsewhere, especially open environments where there's not a whole lot of sort of thorny vegetation. It can be really quite a remarkable experience, especially if you have friends with you, if you have some safety measures, GPS or some sort of spot device to let people know. But I think what I describe in the book is that the fundamental experience of going off trail, which is the experience that most people, 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago would have experienced, is the feeling of being totally cut off from all other communication with other people, wandering off into the unknown. And that's something that I went and did in Newfoundland. I went to hike in a park called Gros Morne, where they don't allow any trails, and you have to pass a map and compass test just to be admitted, to be allowed into the park. And I went off there. I had no GPS. I had no cell phone. I was on my own. I had no one else with me. And the feeling, as I describe in the book, was pretty terrifying. It was a sort of constant anxiety that I had about getting lost and just about the minute details of where to go from moment to moment. I was amazed how taxing it was, how much more of my brain power it required to walk through this environment, which I must admit was an extremely difficult environment to cross. It had these trees called tuckamore, which are elfin wood trees. They're very stunted spruces, which can be just terribly difficult to fight your way through. They would just scratch these red gashes in my legs, and they tore the water bottle pockets off my backpack. It was just a brutal environment to walk through. So it's an extreme example, but I think that it illustrates nicely why we love trails so much. Because when I was finished with that hike and I reached this stone cairn and found my way back to the trail, I found this flood of relief to be back, just back in contact with other people, back on a trail that I knew would lead me home.
The tuckamore sounds really difficult. I noticed you're writing about, I figure I can make it from here to there in 10 minutes, and 30 would pass before you'd even get to that point.
Yeah, it was surreal. It really was.
Well, that's tough stuff. So why were there no trails allowed in that part of Newfoundland?
Oh, it's just a deliberate decision on the part of the park. I think that there is a movement now to try to have pathless wildernesses. You know, in fact, in Oregon, there's a trail called the Desert Trail, which is a kind of anti-trail, meaning it's a route leading from Oregon all the way down to the border of Mexico, but it has no markings at all. And I think that people who have spent their lives walking on hiking paths, some people are looking for something a little bit more raw, a little bit more primal, a little bit less guided. And I think there is some value in that. It's just not for everybody.
So when you were going through the Tuckamore, you were letting us know about some other people who, in a sense, you were following in the footsteps of, Aldous Huxley among them. Tell us about his stroll in Borneo.
Yeah, he stepped into it was really not a very long hike. I don't know the exact distance, but it was a short hike through the jungles of Borneo, where the road had sort of washed out, and he had to make his way through the jungle on foot. And he describes a feeling of just an enormous menace. You know, he calls it the vegetal monster, the feeling of this jungle closing around him. And what it does for him, you know, he's someone who'd grown up, I think as many of us have, with very romantic notions of what the wilderness is. Having read Wordsworth and the other romantic poets, he thought of it as a place that is, gentle and kind, and a place, is Mother Earth, right, this very mothering presence. And what he ultimately concludes is that, of course, it's not. It's an inhuman place. The wilderness does not care about us. And he found it intensely menacing. Of course, he sort of, you know, rather cleverly referred to it as a stepmother, a sort of wicked stepmother rather than a mother. And that is a realization I think anyone who's ever been lost in the woods suddenly comes to, where we are disabused of our illusions about how caring the Earth is about us, and we realize the Earth is a planet, is an incredibly complex thing, and it does not have any special care for us as a species or as individuals.
Yeah, nature's indifferent, which is it's an interesting thing when you go through the various people have thought about this and realized, oh yeah, I could live or die, and it really doesn't make much difference to the planet at large.
No, and yet the that does not mean that we don't need to care for the planet. You know, the fact that the relationship is not reciprocal does not undo our duty to take care of this thing, because, of course, if we don't take care of it, we will all perish. So, it's a rather complicated problem.
Absolutely. So one of the things you actually had gone to Newfoundland for was to look for the world's oldest trails. What did you see?
Yeah, so there are these trails in Newfoundland in a place called Mistaken Point, which it just recently got designated a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And I'd really recommend anyone who can afford it to go out there if you're interested in geology or paleontology. It's a really beautiful place, and I think Newfoundland is a remarkable area. But these trails are the oldest trails that we know of that an animal has made on Earth. They're 565 million years old, which is just immensely old. It's in the Precambrian. So this is when animals were, for the most part, stationary. We do not think most animals were actually moving at that point. They were just sort of rooted to the seafloor and filtering their food from the sea. And yet one of them, for one reason or another, started to scrunch and slowly move across the seafloor, leaving this trace, which I've seen, I've actually touched it, of these little sort of nesting circles. And you can see how excruciating, how painstaking it was to make each, to move each inch. It's a really moving place to be because you see this first impulse, this first movement of animals, which has led to all the incredible forms of movement that we currently see on Earth.
So essentially we move because we need to. We need to get over there where the food is, or we need to get over there where the predators aren't, or something like that.
Yeah, there are multiple reasons. And when I came to Newfoundland, I had assumed that it would be one of those two reasons that you mentioned. I wondered to myself, what impelled the very first animal to move? And I imagined it would probably either be to kill something, to eat something, or to avoid getting eaten by something.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, that's not what we think it was. This earliest animal, this Ediacaran, the man who's studying them, Alex Liu, his theory is that what happened was this Ediacaran was suctioned to a rock using what's called a holdfast, and it was washed from the rock and ended up in loose, sandy soil, and it was actually trying to crawl back to some solid substrate so it could suction itself there again. So what I say in the book is, you know, that it was actually the very first impulse to move was to go back home.
Interesting. We learn a lot in this book, On Trails, an Exploration with Robert Moore. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We're obviously thinking a lot deeper than guidebooks. It is not that at all. Join us at 800-838-3760 if you have some questions about his process in studying trails and why animals, more than just humans, move. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You just mentioned Alex Liu, and there's I did mention an illustration in the book, and it's a concept idea with letters of what you saw when you looked at the rocks in Newfoundland and what he saw. And I only now, looking at the second time at your iteration of what you saw, I actually do see the word fossil appear a few times in there. But for him, it was like zeroing right in on it. Boom, the fossils just jumped out to his sight.
That's right, yeah. It's a sort of perceptual filter that he has. He's able to spot the fossils very quickly because he knows what he's looking for. Whereas when I looked at it, I just saw sort of chaos. I remember there's a great anecdote of this biosemiotician named Jakob von Uskul, who describes being sitting at lunch. This has probably happened to you before. He was sitting at lunch one day. He was staying at a friend's house, and every day they'd bring water and put it in a clay pitcher on the table in front of him. And then one day, unbeknownst to him, the clay pitcher had been broken, so they replaced it with a glass carafe. And he said he sat down to lunch, and he said, "Where's the clay pitcher?" And they said, "The water's right in front of you." And he couldn't see; he saw nothing. And then suddenly, someone said, "It's in glass." And he said, "It's as if the light from all the silverware, you know, sprung out and gathered together into this glass carafe, which was sitting right in front of him the whole time, and he hadn't seen it." And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about, which is that we have these perceptual filters in life, and sometimes things can be right in front of us, and we can't see them. We kind of see what we're expecting to see.
You know, just back of the general concept of trails. I mean, you really might have missed out on trails, as you tell us, because you're from the Concordtide prairies of Illinois. So what sparked your interest in trails in the first place?
Yeah, I'm from the suburbs, and my parents are not outdoorsy folk. You know, what I always say is my dad doesn't even like to eat outside. He won't even eat at a sidewalk cafe. My mom's a little better, but they're really indoor folk. And fortunately, I was sent to I was fortunate enough to be sent to a summer camp when I was a kid, when I was about 10 years old. A place called Pine Island in Maine, and they sent us off on a lot of hiking trips. And I have to admit, on my very first hiking trips, I hated it. I thought it was miserable. I thought it was drudgery. I couldn't understand why anyone would want to willingly do this, because my back hurt and my feet hurt, and I was just hauling a heavy bag through the woods. And it wasn't until maybe the second day of my first trip, when I finally put down my backpack and went for a walk in the woods, that I saw the beauty of it. And I got my first inkling of how amazing. That's actually the first time I ever saw the Appalachian Trail. It was on Mount Washington. And I got just a glimmer of the wonder there was to be found there, rather than the menace. You know, I think anyone who didn't grow up in the woods knows that feeling of being afraid out there. But there's also so much beauty, and it takes a little bit longer to find your way to the beauty.
And Laura Ingalls Wilder, I guess, helped in your process a little bit.
That's true, yeah. I was a big reader of the Little House books, and of course, Gary Paulsen's Hatchet. I got into the... there's a great deal of wonderful young adult writing about the wilderness, and all of that is, you know, it's a really nice way for kids, I think, to get into it, because they can experience the beauty without a lot of the danger or the discomfort.
All right, we have a call here from Jim and Eugene. I want to get onto the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Robert Moore about his book, On Trails.
Hey, thanks. Thanks, Robert. Yeah, it was interesting to me about how organisms first learned. I was always wondered how they first learned, so to speak, about how to avoid things that were potential danger. But you were talking earlier about ants. I had an interesting experiment where I had ants coming in on my cable wire, and I didn't know how to keep them from coming into my house, so I built an electrical discharge device, and then I waited for them to rebuild their pheromone trail. And then I energized the charge with, it was a high voltage, but not much current. And so I energized the thing, and I watched as the ants encountered this, and it was really interesting because the first ants came back and seemed to communicate to the other ants that, hey, there's a problem up here and we ought to stay away. But that communications, you could see it go down through the whole group of ants, and then it sort of dissipated, and then they charged this spot again, and then more of them got zapped, and the communication was stronger and went further down the line. And then finally, a few of them even just attempted basically suicide, and finally the whole group realized that whatever pheromone message was there was don't go that way, so they stopped. But my question is, did you ever learn anything about how ants scout or other animals scout to find a trail? Because obviously some ant had traveled along this long wire and then gone all the way back and told them, this is a way to get to this house.
Ah, so who blazed the trail in the first place, and who are the trailblazers? Great question. Thanks for that, Jim.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Jim. I think that when people, there's a great story of Mark Twain watching an ant try and find its way to food and back. And what he was struck by was how foolish they look. You know, it was climbing over every blade of grass, and it was just taking an incredibly long amount of time to get from one place to another. And that is what entomologists often tell me, is that the scouts are just sort of randomly exploring the environment and hoping to happen upon something. And it's actually a very messy, very slow process. But then, it depends upon the species, of course, but typically, as that ant is going out, some of them have the ability to count their steps or to, that we think to actually orient themselves using sort of electromagnetic sense. But what most ants are doing is they're leaving a light trail of pheromones on their way out to find the food. And on the way back, once they find something, they'll follow that trail back home. And once they find the food, they're leaving a much stronger trail back home because they're signaling to the other ants, I found something. And there's a great story of the physicist Richard Feynman, who did an experiment similar to the one that you ran, where he had some ants coming in his house into his bathroom. And what he did was he left a cube of sugar on one side of his bathtub. And as the ants would go and find the sugar, on the way back, he would trace a line using a sort of a colored pencil on the bathtub. And what he found is that the first line, as the ants were walking home, that first ant was coming back, was very squiggly. It was full of errors, he said. And the second ant, as it followed that trail, it slowly started shaving off the inside turns and taking little shortcuts so that the line became a little bit straighter. And the third ant followed that line and made it a little bit straighter. And that's how these ants manage to create these really efficient systems, is just through this process of constant streamlining. So even if the first ant made all sorts of mistakes in finding its way home, by the time the whole colony has followed that trail enough times, it will have corrected for those mistakes and made the trail much more elegant.
Trail by committee, but a good committee. And this, I think, is why you say that we do tend to glorify trailblazers, but the followers are really important as well.
That's right. Yeah, the followers are just as essential to the overall system. And that's something that I think as Americans we are raised to believe that you should be a trailblazer or you're basically a lemming, you know, or you're a sheep. We use these various animal metaphors to shame people who are followers. And as a writer, I feel this very acutely. I think most artists probably do. Do you follow in a tradition or do you strike out on your own? And I think I ended the book by realizing that there's some merits in both.
Well, and as some people like to say, lead, follow, or get out of the way. We'll talk more about trails and who creates them and who follows in the footsteps of those who've gone before. Robert Moore's book is called On Trails, An Exploration. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the environmental journalist Robert Moore, who's written his first book. It's about trails, but it is not by any means a guidebook. You're not going to figure out which trails are the best ones to take some places, although he did take lots of hikes, including a notable one on the Appalachian Trail that was rather muddy through the summer and got him to thinking more deeply about the trails themselves. The result is this book, On Trails, An Exploration, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk much more deeply about the need for creatures, not just humans, to move from place to place and the trails they create in the process. 800-838-3760 is the phone number if you'd like to join the discussion. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Well, we spent a lot of time talking about ants, but I do want to get to some of the bigger animals because you did go on the trail of things like elephants and buffalo in the process of writing this book, didn't you?
That's right. Elephants, buffalo. I went and herded sheep. The larger mammals, the bigger the animal gets, actually, the more interesting the problem becomes, because with little ants, tent caterpillars, insects like that, it's clear why they follow trails, because they don't have very powerful brains, so they can't really find their way from here to there without the aid of trails, or at least some of them can, but it's much more difficult for them. Whereas for us, why do big mammals follow trails? It's a question that I was wondering quite often. What do they do for us? And so I went to an elephant sanctuary in Tennessee where a friend of mine was working. I went to the Navajo Reservation in Arizona and spent some time herding sheep. And I spent time with a hunter in Alabama, learning how deer follow trails. And what I ultimately found was that, of course, mammals follow trails because even though we have the ability to cross a landscape without trails, it's much easier. And we are always drawn to the path of least resistance. Every animal is trying to conserve and to optimize our movements in various ways, and trails are a really elegant way of doing that.
Interesting point in the book, too, about horses, how if you let them roam free across the landscape, we'd probably end up with nothing but straight lines for ways to get around.
Well, that's true to a degree. If horses were allowed to run, if they are always running, then they will straighten out their trails invariably. But if they're just walking, actually, they will follow a meandering trail, because this is one of the big lessons of my book that I came to ultimately, is that a trail sleekens to its end. And what I mean by that is first of all, obviously the trails streamline if speed is their end, if that is their goal. But if the goal is not speed, if it's something else, then actually they take on very different forms, you know. So say you're trying to get over a mountain from one side to the other. If you're trying to maximize your speed, you might run straight up the mountain, or you might, you know, eventually tunnel create a tunnel through the mountain. If you're trying to minimize your energy output, if you're trying to save your energy, you actually might create switchbacks, right? You might make a more windy trail. And that's true across animals. You find this, that if you can figure out what they're optimizing towards, you can then understand why the trails take on the shapes that they do.
We have a call on the line here from Lane in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Robert Moore, the author of On Trails.
Hello, Mr. Moore. I'm fascinated by your book, partly because I've taken trails all my life, and the other reason is because I'm part of Jackson County Search and Rescue, and we're all about trails and finding where people went and being able to take trails to go find them and finding out why they got lost. Anyway, so I will mention, I will buy a copy of your book, of course, and buy copies for others and mention to my fellow members about your book. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Lane. Appreciate
it. Thanks so much, Lane. Yeah.
So Search and Rescue, did you run across any people who use trails in that respect? I mean, you talked about the hunter, but they're not looking to rescue anybody.
No, although that is a very interesting thing. I mean, trackers in general are an absolutely fascinating element of trail making, because that is a very ancient way that we follow one another across the landscape. And of course, you come across all sorts of interesting anecdotes, the most famous being among many, and I'm sure as a search and rescue person he Lane could tell us this, that many times they'll say that a person will walk in circles if they have no way of navigating. I remember actually hearing this from a tracker when I was a teenager. And then I went to go research it to find out if it's true, you know, that if you have no way of navigating and you go out into the woods, oftentimes people say you'll walk in a full circle. And in fact, I think the tracker that I talked to said he would just wait for the person. He would start following their trail and then kind of wait because he knew they would come around eventually. And what I found is that that's true, but only to a degree. So they've done studies with this, where they'll actually give people GPS devices and send them off in the woods with no way of navigating, no compass. It's a cloudy day, so they can't really tell where the sun is. And what they find is they do walk in circles, but it's more like a squiggle. They will circle around to hit their own trail, but it's not as if they have a circling instinct in their brain, which makes them walk in a spiral or in a circle. It's just sort of a random walk. But the terrifying thing about that is that if you were lost in the woods, as I've been and probably as you've been and many people have been, and you have no way of navigating, you're not going to make it more than 100 yards in any direction because you're just going to keep wandering in this sort of random squiggle through the woods.
Is that partly because we get, less confident or something and think, well, maybe we should turn a little bit this way or maybe I should turn a little bit that way?
I think the person I talked to about it said that it's really just very hard to keep a straight line. It's much harder than you think. It's actually a very difficult neural balancing act to walk in a straight line. If you've ever had a blindfold on and tried to walk in a straight line, you know it's quite difficult. And in the woods, where you're in a chaotic topography and there are all sorts of obstacles, it becomes much harder. So people just can't stick to the line they're trying to follow unless they have a navigation device.
In your exploration of human trails, Robert, how much did you find out about us taking our cues from other animals? I mean, it seems like if a deer's gone down a path and we're out looking for deer, we're going to follow that path. And if larger mammals have blazed trails, why not use those and conserve our own energy?
That's right, yeah. And in many places, you do find that the paths of least resistance were first discovered by other animals. So in Africa, many of the highways, many of the road systems followed elephant trails. And here in North America, it was bison trails. Buffalo trails led us across the lowest pass through the mountains. You know, there's a place called the Gangplank in the Colorado Rockies, which is the only place where you can climb the Rockies without having to create switchbacks. And that's where they ended up laying the railroad tracks. They found that by following the Native American trails, who were in turn following the bison.
And the Native American trails were, I mean, this is a non-wheeled society, so how important were the trails to interconnectivity, civilization, culture, all that?
They were absolutely integral from what I can understand. I went and spent some time with a man named Lamar Marshall, who is mapping all of the old Cherokee trails in North Carolina. And you can actually go out into the woods and still find old remnants of Cherokee trails. Of course, it's much harder because, as Lamar Marshall explained to me, many of those Cherokee trails ended up becoming the road network in North Carolina. So something like 80% of them are actually buried under the asphalt of our current road network. But you can still find these trails. And what you find when you read back through folk literature and much of the spiritual literature of Native American communities across North America is that trails were interwoven with stories. And that was the way that sense was made out of the landscape. Most of the old Native American folktales describe places. They're very tightly connected to places and will describe a journey, a character's journey across this landscape. And there most likely would have been a trail along that same line. And so the earth and the literature was all very tightly interknit and actually quite inextricable. And when you take one away, the stories actually start to lose something. And so that's it, when you think of it in those terms, it makes a lot more sense why, for example, a Native American community was, when they were forced, like the Cherokee or the removal, when they were forced out to Oklahoma, it was so deeply painful because their culture was inextricably tied to the land where they were living.
Sure, sure. And they got sent to a place that was totally alien to them. Absolutely.
Of course. And barren, yeah.
The we've talked mostly about land animals and spent a lot of time on ants here. And you do get into sea anemones in the book and talk about little pathways they make. Fish, though, I mean, in the actually open water, things that aren't rooted to structures in the ocean, do they make anything like trails or anything, you know, pheromones like ants or anything along those lines?
Not from what I could tell. In an aqueous environment, it's quite hard to have those kinds of lasting signaling mechanisms. You know, the reason why trails work on Earth is because they last long enough for other people to follow them. But there are, of course, migration routes. And you know, whales, for example, follow very complex, very long-lasting, perhaps millennia-old migration routes. And that's true as well of skyways, what they call skyways. This is the Great Atlantic Skyway, which is a migration route for birds that runs up the Atlantic. And so these, I thought about that, you know, this is a pretty sprawling book, and I had to draw some boundaries so it didn't sprawl endlessly, you know.
Because the oceans are very deep.
7 years to write the book as it is. It could have taken me 70 if I'd included everything. So I left out the skyways and the water trails, but they in a sense they are trails. But the key to the trail for me, and the reason why those aren't strictly speaking trails, is that there has to be a feedback mechanism. There has to be a way that one animal can leave a trail, another animal follows the trail and starts to alter it a little bit, and the next one follows it and alters it a little bit. That's where I think the real wisdom of trails starts to come in.
Somebody can see that the ground was disturbed here. Looks like somebody went this way, so I'll go this way too.
That's right, and then you go that way too, and maybe while you're walking, you find a little shortcut that makes that trail a little better. I mean, do you do much hiking yourself, Jeffrey?
Not very much, but some.
If you've ever been out, you've probably noticed you've noticed a place on a hiking trail where the trail will go one way, and then there will be a little informal trail that makes a little shortcut. Those are called, in urban planning, those are called desire lines. You've probably seen them in city parks as well, right? If you see a big expanse of grass, there will probably be a little trail cutting across that grass. And the reason why that's happening is because people want to follow the path of least resistance, but designers don't always want to make trails follow that for various reasons. Urban architects like big expanses of grass because it looks beautiful. There's a long tradition in the landscape architecture going back to Olmsted and back to the English garden, the various reasons why we want big expanses of grass. On a hiking trail, they want the trail to shed water efficiently, right? They want it to be sustainable. And that does not always align with where walkers want to go. So you see this fight between trail builders and trail walkers. And what will happen eventually is if the trail doesn't go where hikers want it to go, hikers will just go there anyway. You know, I was recently in Central Park, and I saw an area where they had built a fence to try to stop a desire line. And someone had just walked up and stomped down the fence and kept following the desire line. And you see that everywhere. Once you start looking for it, and this is something that trail builders say as well, is they'll install signs, they'll put up bushes, you know, rhododendron bushes. They come back 3 months later, and the sign's been torn out, and the bushes have been stomped down because people just, we're like water. We just want to flow across the path of least resistance. So it's a really interesting thing to talk to trail builders about how they manage to convince people to walk the line they should be walking rather than the line their first impulse leads them to. And what they tell me again and again is that you have to listen to people's desires. You know, if people want to go to a waterfall, you have to build a trail there because otherwise they're just going to go anyway. And the trail that people make is not going to be as sustainable as the one that you can make for them. So I think it's a really powerful metaphor for the ways, for example, the environmental movement in the United States. How do you convince people to be doing what we know for our collective good we should be doing, but what, for our individual first impulse we may not do, how you convince people to recycle or to walk to the store rather than driving there, or what, all those various things that are a little bit harder, but we know in the long run will be good for us. It's a really difficult problem.
Truly. But, you know, the idea that we do tend to follow each other anyway. So there's a community sense there, even if it's not all committed at the same time. Speaking of which, coming back to the Appalachian Trail, through hiking can be a real solitary pursuit, but you found quite a community out there, didn't you?
I did. That's true. I think that we typically think of hikes as a time to be alone. You know, the word solitude actually has the same Latin roots as the word wilderness. Those two concepts are very closely tied. And yet, what I found on the Appalachian Trail was a community. You know, I'm sure you've heard of trail names, you know, that hikers get mm-hmm. trail names when you go out there. And it's sort of an opportunity for people to reinvent themselves and to build this ad hoc community out of nothing. And you have all of these traditions as hikers and all this culture that springs up. And also, you're out there, you know, in the woods, and you're kind of vulnerable, and so people band together to help one another out. And that's something I saw really beautifully. I have a friend named Gil Jackson who believes he's the first full-blooded Cherokee man to hike the whole Appalachian Trail. And I went and hiked with him for a while, and what I saw was, you know, he's in his 60s, and he was having a really hard time, and the hikers banded together to help him, to lift him up and get him to the end of the trail. That was a really beautiful thing to see, that trails don't just lead us to the wilderness, they also bring us together.
Well, there's a lot to learn in this book. There's a lot of really interesting information here. It's called On Trails, An Exploration. Robert Moore wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Robert, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeffrey.
All right, take care.